Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today, I'm back with Shai Tubali. This is part two of our conversation, and we're going to dive right into the expansion method, which Shai has brought into the world. The expansion method is a process that gives everyone the ability to expand one's consciousness for healing, empowerment, and transformation. It can also support trauma healing, as well as the journey towards enlightenment. And this process has already helped thousands of people around the world. So we'll get right into how does the process of expansion work. Shai is an international teacher and speaker, a leading authority in the field of self-development. And he combines psychology, philosophy, yogic traditions, and Eastern thought and practices. He's published 12 books and serves as an academic researcher at the University of Leeds. Let's dive right in. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. Shai, so here we are for part two, and I really enjoyed our last conversation. So first of all, how are you?
I'm really having fun working hard.
Yeah, that's an important combination, isn't it? If you can have fun and work hard, that's great.
Yes, especially when you equate work with creativity. It's like, so I'm busy creating.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I might ask you a question about that because I just find people inherently fascinating. Your creative process is something interesting to me, but let's stick to the topic. I want to ask you about the expansion method today. So let's just dive right into that. Could you tell us what the expansion method is, and then we'll unpack it from all different angles and its relevancy for our audience who are coaches and facilitators?
Yes, let's start very simply. The expansion is a way of imitating a natural or spontaneous process that can take place in anyone's mind when they're available in a state of meditation or in a state of spiritual awakening. Sometimes this can occur when someone is facing a glorious nature or listening to mind-broadening music or sitting in the presence of some great teacher. So what happens to us naturally, spontaneously, is that we're starting to feel, and this is perhaps something that we need to pinpoint because it's a very subtle thing, and yet it's perhaps subtle because it's so prevalent, it's so obvious, so taken for granted. It's our sense of awareness begins to spread. Usually it is concentrated like a tiny dot of a sense of observer or someone who is aware of events, someone who is like the onlooker. You know, we always have this kind of onlooker, the one that is aware that they're experiencing, that they're being alive, that and also having questions about purpose, destiny. Am I doing the right thing? So it's that part in us, the observer, that can all of a sudden take a step back and wonder what am I doing here, and what is it all for, and who am I? So it's this kind of part. But usually, it's just a condensed, as a tiny sense and limited a presence or I am-ness. But then in those moments of awakening, we are beginning to feel to experience a spreading, a broadening, a stretching in every which direction of that sense. And we're starting to feel our being, or I am-ness, as bigger than the body, bigger than our thinking mind, bigger than our emotions, our narratives, our past. And in a sense, this is what we call self-transcending experiences. Now, how do we imitate that? Because usually we experience that so spontaneously, uncontrollably, and then we don't know how to return to that experience. You see, that's our biggest problem, I think. And one day, it was, decades ago, I had this kind of inspiration. It just came to me one night that I had an insight into the process and how to systemize it. And I'm saying it with a great caution because, you know, when it comes to awareness, systemization is a troubling term, you see, because what do you mean? This is something beyond systemization. It's exactly that which can be conceptualized. And still, I managed or something happened and I could see what could be done. So expansion is this ability to return over and over again to the state of expanded awareness, a broadening of our I am-ness, broadening of presence, in a way that also can be applied or used for certain purposes, like detraumatization, enhancement of our mental clarity and decision making, and meditation, of course. So that's the principle, and it's very important to note all meditation techniques in the world. This is what they basically aim to do. Even the term Brahman. I'm not sure you're familiar with the term Brahman that comes from Hinduism, from the Upanishads.
Yeah.
So the term Brahman comes from the root of to expand. And Brahman is the indivisible reality, is that is infinite reality, absolute reality. So every time we meditate, this is what we hope to do. Only very often we don't know how to repeat that process or how to truly experience this extraordinary self-transcendence.
Yeah. And so there's also a way that I've seen that you then, as you mentioned already, that you're helping people then expand their state. And then there's a kind of healing or transformation process that can take place. You said like with trauma or maybe you're getting clarity of decision making. So it sounds like the expanded state is allowing for either some kind of like healing integration or access to a kind of more essential kind of knowing or something.
Yes, I really appreciate how you put it. Yes. That's I think has been also a part of my insight because I My intuition is that we usually use this kind of broadening, inner broadening, only for its own sake, for the sake of self-realization. Of course, saying only is does not imply that I'm undervaluing this kind of purpose. That's mysticism. We want to know who we are. We want to know the nature of reality. But then I've come to realize that this ability makes it possible for us to actually affect those limited parts of ourselves. For instance, our stifling memories, our limited thinking mind, our emotional patterns, everything that is contracted causes us suffering. And this has, I think it has something great to tell us. Contraction, the sense of contraction or limitation and the sense of suffering are associated, interlinked, because our true nature is limitlessness. Whenever we experience ourselves as limitless, we are also in a state of bliss. We're happy. And this is even when I have a headache, for instance. A headache is like a sense of stifling, a sense of limitation. Something oppresses my head. Something presses against my breathing brain. So then I feel so much better when all the pathways are broadening. When I'm able to experience a opening, mental opening. And so contraction causes me a sense of suffering. And when I'm limitless, I'm able to affect all those limited patterns. But there is one more thing. I think we talked in our last and previous and wonderful talk, we talked about transformation. I think that was the very opening of our dialogue. And the point of transformation is not that we are just entering some kind of an abstract state of expansion, of consciousness, but we actually start with our limitation. This means that the process of expansion, and perhaps we'll go into the very process explaining what that actually means, is that we are taking, for instance, we're choosing our traumatic memory or a certain emotional pattern or a certain confusion. And that sounds terribly confining with very remote from the state of expansion. But then what we do is that we expand this very sense of limitation. So we use our most stifling patterns to reach that expanded state. And this is the point, because this means that we're in a way alchemizing these materials that usually cause us suffering. We use them in order to transform.
Yeah.
And that's in a way tantra. It's you use those energies that usually cause you suffering to attain spiritual enlightenment.
Yeah, I watched a video of someone doing the expansion method, and it really had a kind of tantric feel to it, that working with the expansion and contraction. And could you actually describe how do you do it? How do you maybe it's the easy part is identifying the troubling emotion, because we all, you know, we're all familiar with ourselves. So how do you start to do this process? How does it work?
You started by your question. You mentioned that it's the easiest part. Actually, it's not so easy always, because somehow sometimes it's very difficult for us to pinpoint that exact emotion, and everything feels quite elusive or unlabeled. And the part of I think that there's been enough cognitive research that has shown us that labeling is the first step toward healing. And that's really interesting. So the first thing that we actually do, sometimes this is a process in itself, that we need to capture that this particular emotional or mental pattern or memory pattern within our being. So first of all, we are beginning to use our inner senses, the very senses that we use for dreaming at night, because at night while we dream, some things feel real. They have fragrances and visions, although they are completely produced by our inner senses. So these very senses are used to capture, to define a particular pattern. Let's take for instance, a traumatic memory. I was perhaps, sexually abused. Now, this sexual abuse, if I ask you now, expand your sexual abuse, you would look at me like, what do you want from me? This is not possible. This is first of all, it's completely confining. Second, it's elusive. It's a memory. But if you use your inner senses and you begin to describe what it feels like, then you look for an area in the body. Then you look for a shape or image that is somehow describes or captures this very memory. Then a color, a fragrance, a sensation, a vibration. You become very particular. Then you begin to experience a pattern. Let's say it's a red. Improvising. It's a red sword inside my lower belly that pierces my lower belly. This is my sensation. And now it's very tangible. It's no longer an elusive memory. And then I begin to breathe into it and to use my visualization power, my inner senses, my intention, my breathing, to begin to visualize how this pattern expands and grows, until it reaches its maximum level. Now, this kind of pattern, it belongs to a certain, let's call it an emotional or mental body, a sheath of consciousness. But if you use it, it's like riding a crazy wild wave. You see, you're not running away from it. You're actually saying something that seems counterintuitive. Why would you expand that which causes you suffering? We always want to suppress it, to suffocate it, to diminish it. But here we say, we ask it to show itself completely to us. Let's see you in your maximal glory, in your complete appearance. Now, this kind of willingness begins to in a way spiritualize this very pattern, and slowly it begins to grow until it becomes a significantly less dense. And if you repeat that process again and again and again, after 3, 4, 5 expansions, all of a sudden, from a traumatic state, you are beginning to experience a blissful, a broad sense of existence. And I think this is when the miracle happens, because when you sit with a traumatized person, and I'm talking about severely traumatized cases, and you begin, you think at first this is not going to succeed. It's the person is broken.
Mm.
But then this very sense of suffocation gradually transforms, until they use the very same thing that stifles them to experience themselves in the most expanded state imaginable. So that this is how we do the process of transformation. It's very systematic and very simple. All you need to do is define, capture this pattern in a tangible sense, then visualize with all your being how it broadens. And at a certain point, it's like a soap bubble that explodes. This is the sensation. It's like these soap bubbles, how they grow and grow and grow, but then they become more and more vulnerable, and then they explode. And this is exactly the sensation, and you're actually feeling it in the room, that someone's energy field has all of a sudden become pervasive. It's everywhere. It's the person has become much bigger than he or she thought they were.
The example of sexual abuse is amazing to hear about this. And like, I feel that this is one of the emerging, or, you know, I think it's emerging into the mainstream more, like the use of working with expanded states and healing, because of the tendency for people to be trying to fix their conditioning and their psychology from their conditioning and psychology. So they kind of get caught in, you know, a kind of cat and mouse game, or like a loop, you know. And this example of sexual abuse, because I can imagine, like, the question comes up for me, and maybe people listening is like, wow, like, what could that, would there be a danger of re-traumatizing somebody, asking them to expand that kind of embodied conditioning that perhaps is actually very difficult to acknowledge and to be with, and has, you know, really caused a lot of pain. And then we're asking them to expand it and even allow it, you said to show itself fully. You know, part of me is like, wow, that would that potentially re-traumatize them, or would they get scared by that? Yeah.
Yes. I think I would have had these very same doubts if I heard this kind of description, but it's only when you have an ongoing experience of seeing people in this state. Now this is, you're touching on a very, very significant point. You see, because the point in trauma and in difficult memories is the very fact that we've avoided them. This is actually what makes them a monster-like. This makes them grow bigger and bigger in time, because we fear them, feeling that we're too small to contain them. And this is actually the crux of trauma. The crux of trauma, let's give one example to make it vivid. For instance, someone who, it's a real story, someone who at her 18th birthday, her parents sat in front of her and told her, "We wanted to share with you that we actually have never, we are not your biological parents. You were adopted at the age of zero, and we didn't want to tell you that because we wanted you to have a healthy childhood." And now she is sitting there, and all of a sudden, her entire narrative has been turned upside down. The entire reality that she had trusted is no longer valid. And now she somehow needs to reorganize the entire event. And of course, at that moment, woman experienced a profound shock, because shock is when I encounter, my brain encounters a reality that it doesn't know how to interpret. It doesn't know this data. So because it cannot digest it, it actually, in a sense, our rational system withdraws. We experience a loss of power. It's as if we are powerless to handle the situation, to interpret it, to digest it. And in a sense, we are entering a state of freezing. We are, even if we are reacting, responding somehow, it is completely instinctive. It's not there. There is no sense of presence or rationality or actual response. And we are, of course, experiencing a resistance to that event because we don't want to experience it. We don't want to have this kind of destabilizing reality. And our automatic system, automatic thinking begins to form all kinds of crazy conclusions about life. For instance, anything that anyone tells me can be discovered as a complete lie. So I should never trust anyone, even the closest to me. So the heart of a trauma is resistance, avoidance, withdrawal, and in a way, because we withdrew, we have frozen this memory forever in us, and those memory connections, those conclusions in us, and now it's we constantly feel it because it's frozen. It's outside time. It's not a part of the stream of time that of events that can actually change. We experience it as if it happened yesterday, or even as if it's happening now. It's a reality for us. It's like a ghost that seems to remain alive.
Yeah.
So
to jump in, and maybe there's an intelligence to that withdrawal as well. You know, in the moment, even. So, you know, in the case of sexual abuse, there might be, or a child, you know, who hasn't got the capacity to feel a certain level of disappointment or impact, like that withdrawal might be intelligent in the moment, even though it, you know, it's not going to serve the person, you know, ongoing.
No, that's a very wise point. That indeed it's an instinctive defense mechanism. I do teach, by the way, people how to prevent events while they're happening, difficult events, from transforming into traumas. It is possible, but for this, of course, you need to learn that this defense mechanism is not so effective as we hope it to be. You see, but until we, as long as we're not equipped with these kind of tools, we should rather do that, and so that's why I agree. But the thing is that if you really want to uproot that memory and not simply to live with this ghost for eternity, you have to somehow do the very opposite, and the very opposite is becoming bigger than the event. Imagine it as if when in that event and in that memory, it's as if we're experiencing ourselves as tiny dot inside the wide circle that has consumed us. We're unable to contain the event because it feels too big to digest, to understand. But this keeps us trapped forever. Now, expansion, what expansion does is that it makes us the circle, and the memory, just like that tiny dot in the circle. So to be able to if we are able to become bigger, we are able to finally resolve the shock, the powerlessness, the sense of freezing, and all that. So this is why we ask the memory, show yourself completely to me, because we think in our childlike interpretation of that experience that it was so big that we cannot handle it. We couldn't possibly handle it. But if you ask, show yourself completely to me, this already in a way begins to resolve that fear, that sense of powerlessness. You say, okay. And this is, by the way, true when we experience grief. People sometimes say, I'm not going to touch that grief. I can't be, because it's like unfathomable abyss. I will never be able to come out of it. So then what we do is that we experience grief in little bits, in bit by bit, and always keeping some for tomorrow. But as a result, our grief lasts forever. Now, if I say I'm now going to grieve for fully and totally for several days, I'm going to embrace that, to go all the way and to find the edge of grief. What is the edge of grief? So the mind says, no, don't do that. This is, you will just be swallowed in that pit. But if I do that, at a certain point, I discover the edge of grief, and it can finally come to an end. This is the message. Grief can come to an end. Trauma can come to an end.
Yeah, powerful. So you wanted to say something else?
No.
If we take an, like, I'd love to come back to the process itself. So if we take an example, like, like, because this might be more relatable for coaches in terms of, like, they're working with somebody who has trouble, I'm trying to think of an example, like being in their sovereignty, you know, like they're promoted into a leadership position. There's a lack of confidence, insecurity. And so something like that, I'm hearing that you would invite them to think of like a time where that state began. I mean, in a way, I'm asking what the process is like. You would help them identify like the source of it, and then invite them to expand that source. And how do you do that? Like, so could you take us through the process a bit more, in a bit more detail? Yeah.
Yes, of course. First of all, it should be understood that the expansion is not just one process. It's there is the principle of expansion, which is this systematic identification of a certain pattern and expanding it over and over again. But then there are around 30 variations of expansion, which means that there are very elaborate techniques that are designed for specific purposes. So now if I sit in front of, for instance, this person, I have many different pathways to choose from, depending on our discussion and what I identify as the person's needs. Are the person's needs truly therapeutic? Or perhaps it's all about mental clarity? Or perhaps it's a time for decision making, or perhaps they have a question. So it's not necessarily that we go to memory. I think sometimes we are over conditioning ourselves with this kind of cause and effect type of psychological analysis. It's like everything. I am now stuck. Why this is probably because I was alienated from my mother when I was 3 years old and all that. I don't believe in this kind of cause and effect. I'm not impressed with it. And I even identified, for instance, that some people have strange memories that cannot be even originate in their life, in their specific lifetime. And sometimes we need to go in that direction to work on those memories, even though they don't have any rational explanation. So we shouldn't look for that cause and effect relations. Instead, we should really be listening to the needs of that person. So sometimes we use expansion for the sake of expanding a question. And sometimes I look at a person and I think this person is this person's problem is not that they have a problem, is that they constantly think that they have a problem. And then what I would do is I would take a very surprising pathway, such as expanding positive emotions and what I call positive traumas. Positive traumas are, I think it's an amusing concept, but it exists, that it states that just as we have certain very troubling memories in which we experienced ourselves as utterly limited and powerless, in the very same way we experienced ourselves sometimes tremendously broadened and expanded and blissful and fully knowledgeable or with the utmost clarity. So these have also been become ingrained in our system. They're also in a way engraved in us and can be their power can be unleashed at this very moment. So sometimes this would be the path to overpower that sense of problem consciousness.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you for that, because that really gives me a real sense of like the possibility here. So it's really, you're really tuning in to, and there's an art to that, I imagine. Like, what is the real need here? What's really happening? And then you're inviting, and it might be a positive quality as well, or a resource, and you're inviting it to expand. And how do you do that? How do you invite, you know, literally here, you're like inviting it to get bigger. And I gather you're also maybe using breath, or what is that process of inviting things to expand? And is there a limit that it comes to, or do you want it just to keep going? Or you said you kind of come, you might do it 3, 4, 5 times or something. Yeah.
Yes. Well, sometimes when it's people have a difficulty, first of all, because some people are, I think one of our painful discoveries is that we become attached to our narratives, even to our traumatic memories. And sometimes we don't want to let them go. So suddenly, when we realize that expansion begins to dissolve our narrative, or at least our attachment to the narrative, people become really worried and they begin to resist that, that. And then they need to be gently persuaded to give it a try, to see what it would be like if you expanded, you see? And then, of course, that they realize that this position of keeping them away from the possibility of bliss is not something that they want to keep doing. Well, so first of all, yes, we realize that there is we can expand it again and again, but of course first of all there is a certain level of maturity, how much people can contain, and people I'm talking here about fresh beginners in meditation, people who've never meditated. Executives who have not known even these concepts. Sometimes we don't even explain anything. We just dive into the process. And very extraordinary things take place, because people use terms such as limitlessness, I am the cosmos, infinite light, total freedom, and so on and so on. So at a certain point, the maturity of our nervous system is going to inhibit the process. At a certain point, we will be simply unable to keep expanding. It's we reach something that currently we feel is an unlimited space. Now tomorrow it will be a limited space compared to our further revelation, but now it is our greatest expanse. And also, we need to understand that at a certain point, there is a limit to expansion because there is because it's all about what creates the limit is our conceptualization, the borders of thought and feeling. And this is, I think, what brings us already to the understanding of spiritual enlightenment. Spiritual enlightenment is your awareness just as it is right now, only without the mental and emotional borders that you've imposed on it. We are erecting these barriers, but if we remove them or see through them, well, our awareness is infinite. And that is our true nature. So yes, we expand and expand, and each time we're discovering that by dissolving the limits that we've created of self-identity, of emotional patterns, where we think our mind cannot move any further, that our mind has certain walls and ceiling and floor. All of a sudden, we're managing to move, to pass through these walls, this ceiling. And really, just as they say in the Mahamudra tradition, in Tantric Buddhism, if you look for the edge of the mind, then you realize that there is no such edge, and that is Mahamudra.
Yeah. I want to stay in this topic. You know, I want to just do a little. I'll come back to this topic. I've got a lot of questions about where we're at right now, but first, want to make sure just that sense of the expansion process. So, you know, is it that? So, you know, I know you've said like we can apply it to many different situations.
Yes.
So, is it that you would, for example, find a sense of sensation, location of where a certain contraction might be in the body, how it feels, and then you would, you know, and in the demo I saw there was a kind of inviting someone into the core of it, and it was like breathing into the core and inviting it to reveal itself and to expand. Just that kind of process of actual expansion, I'd love to just touch into a bit more before we go back to some of these things you're bringing in.
Yes, exactly. Well, this whole principle comes from my education in the field of the subtle body, because the subtle body includes what is called the chakras traditionally. And therefore, when we are beginning to delve into that areas in the body in which a particular sensation is felt the most, this is also always linked to particular chakras. So now, for instructors who are well versed in this field, they know how to connect the dots. You see, this is now they're experiencing it in that area in the body because it is related to these life themes that are associated with a certain chakra. So what we do is that it's very important. I think our anchor is the body. In this sense, it also involves some somatic work because we are involving the body, and the sense the body always reflects our subconscious and is actually is like the echo of the way we create these limited patterns. So that's why we are moving into that area in the body, and we move into the very core, the very heart of that sensation. Now, this is very different from analytical processes. It's not like now that you're expected to explain what you're finding there. You're not asked to now explain why it is so. It is more like what does it feel like? Which means getting in touch with the actual sensation, the actual feeling, and start labeling it, giving it names in order to capture it. So the body is our anchor in this sense because it makes it so tangible. If I say I feel grief, that is very broad. I cannot hold it in my hand. But if I can hold a pattern in my hand, I can see it. And if I can see it and feel it, then I can also begin to expand it like a bubble.
Yeah. And the question, it really does remind me of some of the tantric practices I've encountered in Tibetan Buddhism, where, you know, you're really going into the, you know, the subtle experience and actually the energetic experience of kind of the patterned energy. And one of the things that I'm fascinated here is like the change agenda, because there could be, and I'm sure you've got a great answer to this, is there a danger of like almost like having a change agenda for this contracted patterning? You know, actually, I'm wanting it to expand, you know, I'm making it expand. And there's actually, maybe that's even coming from some other part of me that doesn't like it being here. I want it to change. Yeah. And actually, my experience is that actually has the opposite effect. It reifies the energy in some way.
Yes. Do you mean that that we might want it to expand in order to make it go away?
Yeah, basically the simple. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. This is true. Of course, there are always there is always in any kind of transformative process. There's the danger of there are two types of people, generally speaking. There is the type of people who that really is overly attached to their patterns, to their narratives, and they really want to delve into them endlessly. So if you take it away from them, they don't know who they might be without these narratives, and they really fight to keep them for dear life. It's don't take it away from me. And then there is the other type of people, which could be perhaps I will borrow that term, which like to spiritually bypass their patterns in the sense that they want to simply not feel. And you identify this tendency when people have a very easy time expanding everything. You see, it's you simply ask them to expand and they immediately leap beyond the memory.
I've met these people, yeah.
Now, if you notice this kind of pattern, you need to do the very opposite as an instructor. You're beginning to make that person notice that they first need to really meet that pattern. They really need to be with it, to let it be. Because again, the principle is that you cannot uproot something that you don't know. It's sometimes we think that we can transcend the anger without understanding it, and there's a transcending desire without understanding desire. But unless I really have made myself familiar with the nature of desire, with its mechanism, and I understand why I'm also attaching myself to that desire, and I don't want to let it go, and I feed it and make it thrive. So unless I fully know something, I can never be liberated from it. So that's why expansion has to somehow take place in that middle path, in which people, on the one hand, they are agreeing to let go. On the other hand, they are agreeing to get to know their inner content, and they are using the process in order to finally get to know these energies intimately, fearlessly, compassionately. So that's why the process is it's on the one hand, it's what does it feel like? Moving to the very heart of that feeling, get to know it, identify it. Don't move too quickly to that transcendent state. But because otherwise it cannot really transform, and without having it fully transformed, you see, in a profound way, the materials that they remain there dormant. Some part of it remains intact within your consciousness, and it will simply replay itself as soon as you've opened your eyes. So if we want transformation, it has to combine these two elements.
Yeah, beautiful. I really appreciate your articulation of that kind of path that we can walk there with this, really clear. And so somebody is, this thing is expanding, and like you, that, I think that bubble metaphor is so beautiful. It's because it, you know, it gets so thin, the membrane, that it can no longer kind of, so, you know, and then it pops. So there's a sense of like this thing will expand, and what happens then in terms of, you know, is it the actual expansion itself that has transmuted the patterning, or is there a need to look back at the patterning from the expanded space? And even, you know, with the case of getting clarity, you know, you mentioned you can also apply it to getting clarity. I'm imagining it might be you've expanded and suddenly there is some kind of clarity emerging from the expanded state. So I'm mixing my questions. It's bad podcasting, but I can't help myself because I'm so fascinated with the topic. Yeah.
By the way, the image of the bubble is also was also used by Yogananda, and he actually described the process of expansion, and after teaching the expansion for a while, somebody came to me and said, "Did you know that that Yogananda also had their address that?" And then they showed me a wonderful metaphor Yogananda describes in relation to positive moments. When we have positive moments or in life or positive feelings, he says, don't be content with that tiny bubble of joy, but let it grow and grow and grow until that bubble explodes and leads you to the ocean of joy. So from a tiny bubble of joy, it becomes the ocean of joy. It's like it's used. That's a limited moment is used to lead us to a transcendent, all-encompassing state. So I love it so much, and I always quote it. So yes, what happens is that we need to understand that as soon as there is this kind of explosion of the bubble, or as an explosion of the pattern, that it cannot, it reaches a certain limit, what happens is that it changes its form. Now, when it changes its form, this doesn't mean that it's always immediately positive. Sometimes it changes it for its form into something that is negative, if we can call it negative, or stifling, or still limited, or even more limited. So it's not so immediate. We have to be very patient with the process of transformation, because actually, what happens is that when I work with a certain limited pattern, it leads me first to its origin. So which means it's subconscious layers or let's say more primordial emotions. So then we have to be ready for that. It's not so swift. Sometimes we have to move through several really difficult expansions. until we see the light. Then there is a certain layer that I call the neutral state. And it's really interesting because sometimes, you know, you follow, you observe this process like a scientist, and you realize that there is a certain mechanism. And in that neutral state, usually people say they experience it as the calm after the storm. It's as if there is no negativity, but also nothing really exceptionally positive about that state. And then you know that it's as if you have reached the barrier separating your, what I call this, the mental emotional body. It's our mental emotional content, including the subconscious layers. And then you are beginning to finally reach that barrier beyond which you tap into your spiritual consciousness. Actually, you can say that you're moving from brain and mind to consciousness. That this is how, in my terminology, we can call it in many other ways. So then even that spiritual consciousness has certain layers, and they are identifiable. I haven't been the first one to identify these layers or bodies of consciousness. This is actually, it appears in so many traditions. And there are many different forms of mapping, but generally we can speak of moving from the brain to the subconscious, and the subconscious is a vast field and very complex. And then beyond that, the beginning of our spiritual consciousness, where we are starting to experience all sorts of states. For instance, what I call uncaused emotions. For the first time, emotions that are completely independent, they are related to your sense of freedom, independence as spirit. And you're beginning to experience that you are inherently free, that your presence somehow supersedes time and space. So these are all sorts of glimpses that people actually can get in touch with in moments of spiritual awakening and samadhi. But then if you keep expanding, you don't get stuck in these states, you are beginning to reach cosmic consciousness, and beyond cosmic consciousness, pure consciousness. And beyond that, you cannot even conceptualize that. So what I'm saying is that this kind of process of constant transformation is actually, it derives its power from the fact that it guides you through the different subtle layers of your own consciousness.
Amazing. And I just want to touch into, you know, as you talk about these layers of consciousness, something I've been thinking about is, you know, I think we maybe touched into this in our last conversation as well, but a view where it's almost like I'm going to renounce the world and kind of ascend, you know, into consciousness, and like a consciousness only perspective almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then another view, which is almost like more imminent, you know, it's like it's really form is emptiness and emptiness is form. It's like, there is this world too, and our humanity. We don't actually renounce the world and our humanity, but there's a way in which spirit and matter can come together. And I just wonder where you fall in those two. Yeah, if I'm characterizing it a little simplistically, of course, but yeah.
Yes. Well, I think that we can find here. In the mystical traditions of the East, even when they said, consciousness is form or emptiness is form and so on and so on, I think their general trajectory has always been that of transcendence, which means leaving the world behind. Even Tantra, by the way, I think one of the most, I would say, disappointing things about traditional Tantra is that when you really grasp their concepts, it's still all about transmuting mundane materials for the sake of ultimate liberation. So it's not about really some kind of a love affair of spirit and matter. It's not that. So then I think we need to somehow recreate or retell the narrative of the spirit nowadays. I don't think we can really find this narrative of union in mystical traditions, at least not in a satisfying way. So I would say, as far as I'm concerned, when I speak of all these layers, starting in the well, in the body and the brain, and the personality and ego, what were the ego is simply the limited and useful sense of self used for expression in the world and communication and so on. So, and then there are these ever broadening layers. For me, all of these layers, starting from the most limited to the most unlimited, are divine. And for me, the definition of the divine is not that last indivisible aspect of consciousness or pure consciousness. For me, the divine is the whole thing in totality. And I really cannot differentiate that, because why would I? For me, the world is an expansion of the divine. It's not some kind of illusion. It's a broadening of its own nature. It's like it's in a way manifestation is a part of that. So when we think in this way, it makes a lot of sense why I bring people to that extreme sense of bliss, only to then tell them, okay, so now take a look from that angle at your deepest traumas, at your deepest confusions, at your deepest questions, at your question of service in the world, your relationships. So for me, that angle is a perspective which we then employ to transform our world, and that, this is for me the essence of life. It's how we can draw on the powers of consciousness in order to finally imbue our existence with light. That's the whole process. How to enlighten all of life's dimensions, because they are inherently divine. So that's for me the essence of Tantra.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's just really beautifully articulates the healing power of expanded states as well. That these expanded places can offer a kind of contact and love to these parts or contracted patterns, and they can unravel and release, because they feel there's a kind of transmutation in that contact. You even see it, I think, in things like IFS, internal family systems, like coming from self to be with a part, rather than being with a part from a part, which is what I think a lot of people are doing. And I also this has been a kind of I've wrestled with what you're talking about, because in, my path into spirituality was Buddhism. But after a while, I was like, hang on a minute, everywhere I look in Buddhism, it's like they're talking about everything is an illusion. It's all an illusion, or everything's consciousness, or they emphasize the formless, and then right at the end, like they might give a little kind of nudge back to form, but it's like, it's only the last kind of, and I think I found schools of Buddhism where they really emphasize form and formless, like equally, but it's quite, it's actually quite surprising when you really look into it, how renunciate most of those schools are. So
yes.
Really resonate with what you're saying. And, just something I wanted to bring in, which was like, I have experienced on my path, like almost like dissociated states, nihilistic states, like that came from things deconstructing very quickly.
Yes,
and a dark night of the soul. I've mentioned this before. And I think part of that dark night, you know, there was trauma released, but part of it was like an over emphasis on formlessness and falling into that. Anyway, you know, I went down some dead ends basically. But my point I want to get to is like this sense of dissociation. Like actually what I've found on my path more recently is almost like, oh, like I am here, but it's not like, it's like a recondensing of energy, you know, an imminence and a kind of power that's coming online more. It's not a not a reformation of a separate sense of self, but it's like you actually need quite a lot of energy and self-coherence to be, you know, a practitioner, an enlightened practitioner, a conscious leader in this world. If you're just kind of disparate, if your energy is too disparate, that's, and this is my opinion, but I wonder what you think about what I'm sharing here.
Yes, no, that's really wonderful. Well, I can here return to the point that we spoke about before about trauma, because when we think about those moments, and then we think about introducing the transcendent state into those events, and then we think, well, wouldn't that make us disassociate even more? Because the nature of trauma is disassociation, and now you're introducing this kind of neutral witnessing of the events, this kind of transcendence, unaffectedness by events. So then I would feel nothing. That should enhance this kind of lack of feeling, and even feed this kind of neutrality and apathy or frozenness. But this is the amazing thing for me. For me, the whole thing of being of consciousness is that ability to finally experience life fully. Because the thing is that we don't experience life fully because we are afraid of life. Life feels too overwhelming and feels dangerous. But what if you were transcended and unaffected by time and space? Then why would you resist experiencing life fully with all its myriad emotions and complexities and even dangers? So in this sense, for me, transcendence is the end of suppression. You're finally able to say yes to everything, and that's the very opposite. It's only a question of where you direct the arrow of consciousness. If you direct it to away from life, you would end up being a nihilist in a way, or someone who feels nothing. And I did face that. I remember in my early 20s, it was at the very initial phase of spiritual awakening. The first thing I experienced was a complete collapse of the emotional system. It's everything that I felt strongly about, my whole natural, well, ego-induced emotions of hurt and love and passion and everything simply vanished. And I felt like I had no tools to relate to the world. So yes, there are transitory phases in which you lose that kind of familiar tool. But then if you stay a little bit longer in that patiently, you will realize that this consciousness has, in a way, the ability to finally allow you to feel more, not less, more intensely, more deeply, to really engage with life in a way that the ego can never do.
I feel very inspired by that. I I'm just thinking of some times where I was sharing this with someone the other day where I like came out of a meditation session and felt a little dissociated or like spaced out. And I was like, that's not quite the effect I'm looking for here. Now, I want to share, I come out of most of my meditations feeling like vibrant, and there's a kind of blooming radiance of awareness, So but these, I was like, that's so, this is like interesting. And then, and then I'd like watch this, I'd watch a movie that moved my heart so deeply. And then I'd go outside and my heart would be tenderized and I'd be feeling everything, but I would also be in this state of wonder and intimacy. And I was like, fuck, this is what I want more than, if you'd, I've done a lot of like opening awareness practice. And so at some point it's like, is this it? Like that tender hearted feeling was so rich. I was like, this is the integrated human being, So yeah. And a real place of intimacy with other humans and the art of life. And yeah.
You know what I really love about you this sharing. After so many years of teaching and learning, I've come to realize that in meditation, in terms of chakras, the chakra system in meditation brings us to usually to the higher chakras, the third eye and the crown chakra to self-dissolution and so on and so on. But I always tell people, now immediately after you open your eyes, the right place to be is not the crown or the third eye. You need to really intentionally move yourself down, move your sense of presence to the heart. In interaction with the world, the only center from which we are supposed to communicate and respond, it is our heart, not our higher centers. So, because if we remain in our higher centers, life simply doesn't make sense. So, and we are unable, how can you bridge the self, the no self, and the world, the no self and personality, the no self and purpose, the sense of purpose or relationships, there is no bridge. So in Eastern philosophies, they've demolished that bridge, except for leaving some space for compassion, you see, and helping others to cross that bridge. Only to never return again, but I feel that the bridge needs to be built and sustained in the heart. This is the only place where life can make sense.
Yeah, beautiful. As we come to a close, like, do you feel that there are other practitioners? Like, I love what you're sharing, and I do seem to see other practitioners advocating for this kind of view. Do you think that's starting to emerge a bit more now? Or, the view, I mean, of like, really embracing our humanity and non-transcended spirituality.
Yes, I think what is happening, and of course, in the meeting point between East and West, where we have a lot of failed manifestation of spirituality, because I think very, very often the West tends to become over-exploitative, and it begins to usurp the spiritual forces for the sake of I don't know, materialistic view. Even if we try really hard, it's just too strong. But I think what can emerge and what has been emerging is a sort of a new paradigm. And I think this needs to be established that human beings are not supposed to embody this kind of limitless consciousness and to fantasize, as well as the Buddha taught, to fantasize about annihilating any a possibility of manifestation, even astral manifestation, you should never ever return in any form. It's dreadful. It's an error. It's a cosmic mistake. So I think we are meant to develop a paradigm in which the human being is a meeting point, a living, extraordinary meeting point between the limitless and the limited. And that meeting point takes place in the heart. And if we can finally embody this, I think we'll be able to develop a new spirituality. The mystical truth has always been the same. It will always remain unchanged. But this paradigm needs to change if we ever want to imbue our future with with purpose.
Yeah. Chai, thanks so much. That's a really potent ending for me, an invitation even for people listening. So, yeah, where can we find out more about the expansion method and your work? Yeah.
Well, there is an official website of the expansion, I think the best way is to get to know my work is through the YouTube channel, which introduces, well, I think nearly 800 videos. So that's plenty to learn from. And there is my official website, which is simply shaitubali.com.
All right. Thanks again, Shai. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm so grateful for this meeting. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well. And I'll see you again next time.